and welcome to another episode of In Her Corner, a podcast focused on celebrating and empowering women working at every level of sport, both on and off the field. Today, I'm really excited to introduce a guest whose resume and whole life journey is definitely my life goals. Someone who has succeeded both on and off the field. It's the wonderful Bex Smith. Hi, Bex.
Hey, Sally.
Thank you so much for taking the time to join us. I know you're incredibly busy, but it really means a lot to have you on the show.
Thank you. I really hate it when people say I'm so busy. It's like, well, then schedule your life better. I think this is great.
That is a good mantra. I'm going to start saying that to people when they say no to me to be on the podcast. I'll be like, you know what, Bex Smith says, just schedule your life better, okay?
Yeah, this is cool. I think it's really awesome what you're doing, and we don't do it enough, do we? So I think it's just about taking the time to make, you know, prioritize the things that are important in your life. And this is really cool. So I'm really happy to be here. Thank you for having me with your rock star lineup of women. Jeez.
I wanted to definitely do it big. So thank you for adding to it. So, yeah. So I think, you know, a good place to start. I've always been a long admirer of you, both when you were playing soccer or football, whichever part of the world you come from, as well as obviously now your career as more in the business executive side of things. So I think so for the benefit of those people who've been living under a rock and don't know who you are, can you give a little background about yourself and how you got to where you are now?
Yeah, I'll try to do it in a nutshell. So I was born in LA, but my parents are Kiwis from New Zealand. And I went to college on the East Coast at Duke and started playing. Well, I played all kinds of sports, really, and did all different types of activities. And kind of fell into football because I got, or soccer at that time, got recruited in college to play, well, three sports, water polo, basketball, and soccer. And I just kind of gravitated most towards soccer. So I ended up playing at Duke and then graduated at econ and Spanish, went back to LA, was working in sales. And in my final year of college, I got called up to the New Zealand national team, which was a completely different vibe from all the youth sort of U.S. national team things that I had done and just didn't really like or enjoy. And when I started playing with the New Zealand team, I absolutely loved it. So just realized that I was captain of a national team that could potentially go to a World Cup after Australia left our confederation to go to Asia. And so then decided to go and play abroad. So I kind of, without any agents or anything, just sent a bunch of emails and did some research online and ended up getting some tryouts in Norway and Frankfurt, and then ended up in FFC Frankfurt, which at the time was the best club in Europe, which I think I have no idea. Just luck, I think, on some levels. Then got a contract there. And then from there went to Sweden, down to Australia to play for Newcastle. Then ended my career in Wolfsburg in Germany.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And then during that time, I really wanted to make sure that I continued with my education and my job sort of experience. So I did my my MBA, my Master of Business, and then I did a postgrad in psychology as well. And then kind of worked part-time in all the places I was just because I got bored playing. Yeah.
and did you ever sleep during? I'm trying to understand where you sleep because you speak four languages. You're captain of New Zealand to two World Cups, I believe, right? Yeah. And Olympics, right?
Yeah.
And you won a treble when you were at Wolfsburg in the German Cup and the Champions League.
Yeah.
And also the Cup, right? The German domestic. So I'm just trying to understand, like, when were you sleeping in all of this? For me, like, I love all these things, but I love my sleep. So I'm just trying to understand, when did you get that?
Babe, I love my sleep too. Trust me. my boyfriend at the time, so I was living in Sweden, like northern part of Sweden. And then there were some games where I had to fly down to New Zealand. So you like literally couldn't get any further apart on the planet. And when I'd come home from those trips, I'd just sleep like 15 hours straight, and he'd have to like put a mirror under my nose to make sure I was still breathing. So yeah, I sleep less now than I did then. But and then after that, I worked at FIFA. So when I sort of had to retire because I had a knee injury in football, I then went to FIFA and organized the Women's World Cups. And then after that, ended up in London. Now I'm working with Copa 90 after I kind of founded a production company with my sister in LA So, but we'll get into all that later, I guess. So that was just like the end of the story. Yeah. Yeah.
Don't give away all the good juice. We got to keep them listening. Yeah.
Sorry, babe. Yeah.
So I just want to sort of fast forward a little bit back there, because you said something that was so interesting to me. You said, you know, the energy and how you felt about playing football in the US versus New Zealand was different. You enjoyed it more in New Zealand. What was it that made you enjoy more? Because obviously, for a lot of people listening, the US women's national team is so well celebrated and they're so successful. So is it because it's too intense and competitive from a very young age that it doesn't allow you to express yourself as a player?
Yeah, that's so good. Yeah, such a great question. And you kind of nailed it, actually. I think, you know, my parents have always kind of wanted me or allowed me to try everything. So very much you can try everything, well, almost everything, but a lot of things once. And if you don't like it, that's fine. But at least try to stretch, you know, your interests so that you don't just get sort of pigeonholed into something that you may or may not be good at. And so, I obviously played soccer, but yeah, it just was really intense as a kid, and I really didn't like the environment and the vibe, and it was very competitive from a very young age at like 12, 13, 14, and political. I mean, if your coach was the coach of ODP, the Olympic Development Program, and he happened to be your club coach, he seemed to have 90% of his own players on the ODP team, and I don't know if, you know, I don't know if that was just a microcosm of that, and or if it was across all of the programs, but I just didn't really like the politics and I just didn't enjoy it, to be really honest. I kind of played because I loved it. I was really passionate about it, but it was never something where very different from a lot of my colleagues here in the UK or the players that are coming through nowadays, they really aspire to be professional footballers. And I think it's amazing and incredible that they can. But for me, that was never something I wanted to do. It was never something I aspired to do. That's why I went to Duke and got an economics degree, because I was like, I'm going to do business, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. And it's great that you ended up doing both. And so sort of when you think back to your childhood, when, you know, you were obviously starting to fall in love with football, what was it, football, that you fell in love with? What was that sort of early memorable sporting moment for you, that your way in? What was that thing that made you fall in love and you're like, I absolutely, this is my space, this is where I want to be?
Yeah, I love sports. I think that, like, as a kid and growing up, there's so many different opportunities you have to get educated. I believe that travel is one of them. My parents were very big into traveling. So we did a safari in Kenya and Tanzania when I was like 15. And that was massively eye-opening. And we did Egypt and the pyramid. Like, we basically just traveled my whole life. Yeah. And sports was just another passion point that I had. And I was good at it. You know, I didn't matter if it was in the pool. My mom swore that I was going to be a swimmer, because I basically spent half my life in water. And I actually wanted to be a pro surfer, not a footballer.
Yeah. Yeah. I was wondering about this. Can you tell us a little bit about this love for surfing?
I mean, who doesn't love surfing, Lisely?
You know what? People who suck at it, Bex, you know. Not,
fair enough.
Not everyone has the natural athletic ability you have.
Yeah,
no, I mean, on behalf of those.
Yeah, that's true. No, we grew up on the, like, very close to the beach in LA, and also in New Zealand. I mean, obviously, an island, lots of beaches everywhere, and I just love the beach. It's just such a nice vibe in the ocean, and just remind you the power of nature, and how even though you can feel like you can conquer a wave, you know, 2 seconds later you get thrown around and the dishwasher is on and you're right in the middle of it and you don't know which way is up, and it just kind of keeps you humble, but it's also very relaxing for me. And I just like the lifestyle. The surfer lifestyle is very laid back, very much a lot of music, a lot, just very peaceful kind of vibe. Yeah. So
it's a real celebration of nature and being with one, right? Yeah, we were lucky enough that when we were growing up, we grew up not far from a beach in South Africa. So we grew up watching people surf. And I completely get what you mean. I mean, although I was never good, surfing, so I guess I buck my own joke to say that, I still, who doesn't love surfing? So,
That's awesome. Wait, where were you in South Africa?
So we were in a town called Impangani. So Impangani is in KwaZulu-Natal, so very close to a big town that probably most people will know called Durban.
Yeah.
So there's this beautiful beach there called Richards Bay. So my dad loved the beach and loved sports. So he always took my sisters and I there for weekends. So we would try out different swimming sports. And my mom had this kind of on running joke that she was like, we were going to be the only black kids who could swim.
I love that.
She's like, it's not happening. It's not happening in my lifetime that also my children don't know how to swim.
So yeah. Yeah. It's so funny. It's so good.
But yeah, we feel a lot of our love for swimming and our love for being at the beach. But it's something I'm so thankful that they pushed us to do. And we were also incredibly lucky to be in a country that has, you know, some of the world's most beautiful beaches. So it was easier to, you know, have that. Me and beach surfing.
Yeah, right. We're going. That's it. And I think, you know, just as you're talking, I was thinking, because my parents obviously grew up in New Zealand in Christchurch. So not even like one of the bigger cities, but still quite a small city. And I think that's kind of why they had that sort of spirit of adventure, because they knew that they lived on an island where there were like literally no poisonous spiders, no snakes, really nothing that was dangerous, you know, no natural predators really. And it's just kind of one of those places that is gorgeous and beautiful and really mellow, and the people are really friendly. But it's also, if you want to get out into like the real world, you have to travel. So yeah, thinking about that, like there's definitely no sharks that we ever heard of in New Zealand.
And it's exactly that experience that you're talking about, right? Do you feel like that is what influenced ultimately your career path, your parents' sense of pushing you to have adventure and discover everything around you? Do you feel like that was a huge part of what drove you to take the career?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, growing up, my parents spoke differently from everyone else's parents. Like we were half Kiwis, half American. When we would go back to visit our family every year and hang out with our cousins for like 3 to 6 months at a time, we'd come back with little like Kiwi accents. And so we were always kind of like those kids that were a little bit different. So I think from a very young age, different meant good for us. It was positive. You know, and in England, people like, oh, she's a bit special. And I'm like, that's awesome. You know, for me, I'm like, yeah, of course. That's great to be special, you know, or weird. For me, weird is like it's a compliment. We've always been very comfortable being different and unique. And I've always kind of wanted to be different and unique from everyone. So that spirit of always growing, always learning, always trying to add more bows more arrows to your bow. Where are we going? What's happening?
Always idioms. For some reason you say them well, and then as soon as record happens, it's like, what happened?
Yeah, no, I don't say everything well. That's the difference. Your other guests probably do, but I just saw Katniss when I was talking, so I got confused. That's exactly it. Just coming back to the point that my parents were always very much about like grow, explore, go, you know, live life as an adventure, go live it. And take calculated risks, I think. That's what I've always kind of done, which is why I just left, you know, a very cushy, wonderful sales and marketing job in LA with my family and lots of friends. Not lots of friends, to be honest, but left and
a good trusted circle. You know, you have that conviction because of how your parents brought you up to feel like, yes, it's worth to take a risk and go and discover something new, because it'll add that point of difference that you see as a growth opportunity, but also a life enriching one, right?
Yeah. And I think when I left for Europe, that was like, you know, there's a big difference between the theory of go explore and do something every day that scares you to then like literally leaving everything, signing a year contract, moving to Frankfurt where you don't speak the language, don't know anybody, have to perform every single day on the pitch, off the pitch, like organize your whole life in a different language, you know, with visas and job things and contracts. And I mean, I think it was just a lot for me to handle at 22 years old or 23, no, 22. Yeah. But I'm so glad I did, because, and I think that naivete of like, I can do anything was also a good thing. It was positive in the end.
So how did you manage that challenge there? You know, that challenge of the culture and the language and assimilating, because I've been speaking to lots of different female football players in the last year or so as I started to get more involved in the side of things work. And there's this kind of here in England, and I'm sure you've noticed it, generally in the UK, players don't tend to go abroad in the frequency that they do across both the men and the women's game. We tend to have more, you know, players coming into our professional leagues here. So what is that kind of, if, you know, these are young female football player, which I'm sure they will be listening into this. What are the coping tools you develop to be able to deal with that cultural challenges of being in a new space?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think you're right. Like, the landscape of women's football has changed so much from the days of me writing an email with New Zealand's football letterhead to as many clubs as I could possibly find, to now most of them have agents who kind of deal with that side of thing. But what I think is still kind of missing, or is massively missing, is really the support for players, that, you know, even if you grow up and you want to maybe go to a different league or a different country, you don't really know a lot about it because, A, there's not a lot of visibility. You know, it's not like you can just turn on, you know, BBC or Sky Sports or any of the major broadcasters that are showing all the men's games and watch a game from another league abroad, like in France or Germany or Sweden. But then there's just not a lot of information for players out there on, you know, how to be a professional footballer and what are the tools that you really need to be successful on the pitch, but then also off the pitch, because, you know, we all know that female footballers are not going to be rich. They're not going to be able to retire and never work again, because most of them have to finish their careers at 30, between 30 and let's say 35 is probably average. So they have to plan for their post-career life, and that no one really is helping with, because there's no money in it. There's no commercial incentive for anybody really to help players during that time. You have the players unions that can have some programs, but not every country has a player union. You have FIFPro, which is the world governing body of players, but they don't, you know, necessarily directly deal with players. It's not like you can access them directly, and then agents don't really do it because there's no money in it. They can help you get contracts in different clubs, but depending on your agent, some are better than others. Some don't really understand the player, what they need or what they want, and will throw them into a club that, you know, gets them their biggest commission, but isn't necessarily the best for the development of that player on or off the pitch. So there's so many things now to like watch out for as a footballer if you're a woman, that I didn't really have to deal with. I just kind of like did my own thing. I did all my contracts myself. I negotiated all my different clubs. And that's kind of maybe why my network personally is a lot bigger than current athletes are, which in the end was the best thing for me, because when I was then looking to transition after football, I had lots of different options to go and talk to people, and that's kind of how I ended up at FIFA, was because I had met Tatiana Henny, who was doing an inspection visit in Wolfsburg in 2009. And 5 years later, she kind of semi-recruited me to go and work there, because she heard that, you know, my injury was pretty bad and I wasn't going to be able to come back. And it's through that network that I think is so valuable, but also that guidance is so lacking now. So it doesn't really help to answer your question, what can players do now? But I think they need to just be a little bit more, less complacent with, well, my agent will handle that, or this person will handle that. And they need to sort of take a lot more responsibility for themselves. You know, who are you? Yeah. What are your values? Yeah. What do you want to be posting on your social media channels? A lot of times it's not in your best interest, even though you get £500 or $500 somewhere, it can really damage your brand and your image moving forward. So I think players just need to be a little bit more smart about what's going on off the pitch, and focus a little bit more on that.
Yeah, no, I think there's a lesson to be learned, I think, in all professions, but especially in the professional side of being an athlete, about taking control of your own destiny. I think the fact that you were, you know, so, because of circumstances, you were forced to be so involved in every aspect of making your career work. But that actually taught you a lot of valuable lessons and allowed you to retain a lot of autonomy, which you ultimately need to be able to shape your own path, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And as you're saying that, I think that just carried on throughout my entire career. So I think a lot of people, especially, you know, I'm going to go out on a limb, but I'm going to say a lot of women kind of just accept the status quo, or they accept that, oh, well, when someone says, well, that's the way we've always done it, and that's the way, you know, either you take it or leave it. Actually, there's barely any men that would go, well, okay, I'll just take it. They all negotiate. I did a really interesting course when I was living in Zurich on the art of negotiation. It was specifically done for women because they had found so many stats that showed that most women in their first job, they don't negotiate their salary, and about 95% of men do. And just that first negotiation.
I can confirm that study.
Yeah. Exactly. And I'm wonder how many women are listening go, I didn't negotiate, or they did, and then that's awesome. And then they're not sort of the average female coming into the business place. But that just that first negotiation puts you on a whole different trajectory of earnings for the next 10 years. And so they did like a whole earning trajectory and showed that with the first negotiation, what people understand and know is you've set the standard that you're going to negotiate at every evaluation. And so your salary just continues to go up, and there's that expectation from you that you've set, so that the employer already knows that. So they kind of come to you with those kinds of offers, whereas women are kind of just happy to sit back and see where their career goes and be very thankful if they get a pay rise and things like that. So it was really interesting. And I think that, like you said, if you have autonomy over your career and you know your value and you know where you want to go, and you can look at the market and be honest and say, actually, I have better skill sets than those around me, then you should be negotiating for that.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that's such a good point and such a learning. And I want to kind of delve into that wider to do with the whole women's sport industry, because certainly coming from, you know, I work for a broadcaster, DAZN, and when I look at the opportunities that they are to broadcast women's sport, they're plenty, but there's a lot of there's a lack of real movement to do it. And I want to understand, do you think some of that comes from the fact that a lot of female rights holder sort of sporting bodies aren't good at that negotiation process? Do you think that's why they're not getting a seat, you know, a chance to be on platforms like ours, as well as other mainstream broadcasters? What do you think is that sort of blocker at the moment?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's probably twofold. I think one, the decision-making bodies at those types of places are not diverse enough. I think that they're very singular in their backgrounds and their perspectives and their beliefs of what people want to see, of what audiences are, when the reality is very, very different from that. If you look at sort of the TV audience for men's football, it was, you know, up until, I want to say 5 or 7 years ago, I can't remember what it was, which I read really recently, actually, was mostly male. So you're basically cutting out 50% of a potential TV audience. I mean, that's just dumb. And I think there's a blind spot, because those that are making the decisions are probably male, probably of a certain age, and probably of a certain race. So I think that the more diversity you have in decision-making bodies, and this goes across everything, it's not just broadcast, it's in sports in general, it's in business in general, it's proven that your bottom line, your revenues are going to go up, and you're going to make better decisions, you're going to be more innovative, more flexible, which in times like this is so important and so necessary. So I think the decision-making bodies need to be more diverse. That's one of them. So they go, oh, well, no one wants to watch women's football. Yeah, actually, lots of people want to watch women's football, and they're not just girls, actually. Two, I think that you kind of said it already, but I don't think that those who hold the rights to those sports, like if it's women's netball or rugby or football worldwide, I don't think that they understand the value of what they have. And part of that is because there's not enough data and there's not enough research. So it's kind of the chicken or the egg, or a self-fulfilling prophecy that, you know, well, we don't have an audience, so we can't go and pitch them on the fact that we have an audience, but you've never had the chance to build up an audience because it's never been shown before. So yeah. At what point do you break that cycle and go, I'm just going to do this? And I know it's not a risk, because we know that 50% of TV populations when it comes to sports are being ignored and are not being serviced and are not being served. So, and I'm not saying that only women watch women's sports. I'm not saying that at all, because the stats show that that's in fact not true. But when people like BBC did a report after the Women's World Cup last year, and I think it was like 80% were male audiences watching the Women's World Cup. And they're like, oh, that what that tells us is we need to cater more towards the men for women's football. And I'm like, no, what that tells you is that you've set up a marketplace that only allows male audiences to come in. You haven't ever marketed to your female audience before, so it's new for them. So the fact that you went from 93% male to 84% male, or whatever those numbers are, but they're, you know, about 10 to 15% increase in female audiences, doesn't mean that only 20% of the audiences are ever going to be female. It just means that it's new, that you need to market it better to female, because there's no reason why it can't be 50-50. It doesn't, you know, just because I'm a female, I would have a tendency to watch more women's sports, because that's who I can relate to. You know, that's who I want to aspire to be. But it doesn't mean that I don't want to watch men's. And there's no reason why it can't be the same for male audiences.
No, I completely agree. And I think we've hit a point on the head there that I would like to, you know, kind of talk through a lot of your work that you're doing at COP19, which is around this increasing the visibility as well as growing and cultivating an audience for women's football. Because I think there's a lot of misconceptions about the way in to marketing, generally women's sport. I feel like sometimes the industry as a whole, we forget the lessons we've learned from growing men's sport, that a lot of the professional leagues, you know, if you look at a league like the NBA and the Premier League, I think are two great case studies that show that actually make a case for the fact that we can do the same with a lot of women's sport, is that they both essentially had a lot of initial investment made into them by both broadcast and corporate business that allowed them a lot of time to operate without the target being set on them about making an immediate return on investment. And they grew those sports through the stars that they cultivated in their different leagues, as well as their distribution, right? A lot of the free-to-air broadcast deals they did both in their respective home countries, but as well as abroad, that really kind of grew the status, the stature, as well as that kind of cool of their brand, right? That made their sport so celebrated in that corner. So I feel like there kind of needs to be a going back to revisit that success and saying, okay, we grew NBA and Premier League. How can we apply those learnings again to women's football, for example, and really push it on and give it that same time and investment? Like the Premier League's been around 20 years now. The NBA's been around, you know, nearly 30 years. So they weren't always that popular and successful. They got that opportunity to cultivate, grow audiences first, and then go on and commercialize. And I feel like, why do you feel it is that people aren't prepared to give women's football the same opportunity from your learnings at COPPA? Is there something that you've unearthed there?
Yeah, that's, I think your experience at DAZN probably is massively valuable in being able to have a business case that you could go and show any broadcaster. So I might hit you up after this. But it's exactly true. If you look at women's sports, lots of women's sports, and I'm not talking about all, because obviously women's sports in America is a very different topic, and we can get onto that maybe later, but I think there's reasons for that. But if you look at like women's sports in most of the world, in terms of broadcast and visibility, it's still a very nascent market. It's still a very young market. It's an amateur market, and it's a startup. So if you're looking at like business, men's football, let's just take football in the UK, because that's a really easy example. Men's football in the UK is an old corporate business. And if you compare it to women's football in this country, that's a startup. So you're going to look at how those audiences are in those two different types of businesses completely differently. One has been built up over time, been able to grow and flex, and you've asked thousands of different types of polls. You've used tons of different types of pundits so that you can really be able to understand those audiences and give them what they want, as well as sort of going into a little bit of like new areas. But you can take that risk because you have such a large foundation of a commercially viable business that you can take those risks. Whereas in women's football, it's a complete startup. So like you said, you have to make a massive investment. And the bigger the investment, the more return you're going to get, but it's going to take longer. So what I think a lot of people do, which is a mistake, is if you're going to invest in something, you can't just invest, you know, well, here's $100 that I have as a budget. I'm going to invest 95 in the men's because I know it works. I'm going to give $5 to the women. Let's just see where it goes. That $5 is going to go down the drain, because what are you going to do with $5 to create a league, to create visibility, to really push the stars forward, as you say? So you can't really do anything meaningful with a really tiny investment. So either you invest in it and you do it properly, and then once you do, you allow that time for that return on that investment to come back. And that's where what you're saying, you can't expect the numbers to be there when you haven't properly given it a chance to grow and to flourish. So business is not part of sports that I've seen in the last years. And that's where I think that women's sports fails the most. So I think the solution to that is basically invest, and then invest properly in it. And then don't expect a return on investment within, you know, don't show women's football on TV at 12 o'clock midnight, or have a women's football show that's literally at midnight on a Sunday, and then go, yeah, but we don't really get that big in numbers. What actually has happened is that women's football show on BBC does have a lot bigger numbers than what they expected. But to my point, it's like, well, yeah, obviously it does, because there's no other place for women or people to watch anything about women's football. Basically, how you have described or defined football in the UK is that it's a men's sport. So in order to have an audience that is engaged in women's football, you have to now change that narrative, and you have to show it in prime time with pundits that know what they're talking about, with quality productions, which still doesn't happen. And if you're going to do that, then people, it creates that perception that, oh, actually, we know that women's football is important. And once that perception is out there that it is important, then audiences will want to watch it. And then that's how you build up a proper audience. But it takes time, and it takes the right investment, and it also takes the right people and mentality, because there's always those naysayers that go, well, no, see, football is a men's sport in this country. See, I just did it. I just put it on TV and we didn't get the big numbers. And there's the evidence that it's not. When you need people that understand the value of it over time, that are going to be committed to making sure that it creates a big audience, and that that audience is being served in the right way. And it's not a copy paste, by the way. And you know that better than I do, working at DAZN. But you can't copy what you do for the men and stick it on the women, because it's just a different sport. It's a different vibe. It's a different, there's different elements to it. There's different benefits, actually, of the women's game that have different types of values than men's football does. You know, we're not talking about the big transfer fees in women's football. We're talking about the stories behind the players. So totally different storytelling in men's versus women's football. And those need to be able to come out and to shine. But you have to have the experts that are in women's football being able to make those decisions, which goes back to my first point. If you're going to do it right. But do it right means that you need to have better diversity, more diversity in your decision making, to be able to cater to that audience that, to be fair, most people don't even know, you know, what their tastes are, what they want.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think that point there is so important about the redefining the narrative around football in particular as a business case, but also as generally a sport, how it's celebrated. And I think for me, that's definitely something I got really excited about when I saw you transition into your role at Copa 90. So I think, you know, could you give us a little bit of background about you know, the kind of strategic approach you took to creating what has become, you know, a really compelling new way of looking at women's football through your work at Compo 90. Could you talk through a little bit about how you got there and what it is that drove you to approach it the way you did?
Yeah. Thanks. That's nice of you to say. I mean, when I was playing and looking at sort of the media articles or the content that was coming out or how people talked about women's football, to be really honest, I just felt like the brand of women's football sucked and it wasn't accurate. You know, like when I was playing or coming through, I knew these players are incredible players. Their stories are absolutely fascinating and you could do documentary series on so many of the players that I played with. The sport also, the quality has gone up so much in the last 10 years and continues to go up because there's enough or there's more investment at participation levels. Coaching has gone up, refereeing has gone up. So the actual quality of the sport has gone up, but it just felt like, you know, media and content hadn't caught up with where the sport is at. And so what was happening is every time I'd see it or every time you see it, you just think, oh, that feels like a CSR campaign. That feels like we should pity women. That feels like we should, you know, that they're victims, that they're always struggling. And it just, that just wasn't the kind of sport that I wanted to be a part of. So it just felt like I needed to be a part of a solution to that, which is why my sister and I started this production company in LA called JAMA Productions. And we had one element off of that, which was JAMA Sports. And we just wanted to tell the stories that were so underrepresented in media in an awesome way, you know, to make it fun, to make it feel like, yeah, people want to be a part of that. We don't want people to feel sorry for female footballers or the sport. Yeah, it was banned for 50 years in the UK, but so what? It's still awesome now. Like the players are incredible. Come watch it. So yeah. We did quite a lot of sort of research on audiences and what they think, obviously with my experience talking to a lot of different players, seeing what they think about how the sport should be represented. And then we had a very clear proposition. We had a mission statement. We had a proposition, a value proposition, and a clear sort of mantra that everything would tie back into. So again, comes back to strategy. We had a very clear strategy of what we wanted to accomplish in women's football. And then all the decisions after that are really easy. It was like, well, does it fit in the strategy? Yes or no. If it does, we put it in. If not, then no. And our proposition at the time was that we wanted to change the face of football. And I say football because, again, the definition of football only included men and male audiences. And at the end of the day, the reason why we wanted to do that is because women's football is football.
Yes.
It just deserves to be included in the landscape.
It just is. It's just another. It needs to be treated almost like another league within the category of sport.
Exactly. And that league will have a different taste, a different style, different types of storytelling, different heroes. Yeah. But it still deserves to be a part of the landscape of football.
Yeah, but just like the way the other leagues do, right? Serie A is different from La Liga, different from Premier League, different from, you know, MLS. Women's professional football needs to be treated the same. It's just a different league that, as you say, has different stars, different heroes, and has a different point of leaning in, right? Yeah. And I think that's what I have found so great about the platform that you've created, that there's this different way of leaning in. And I think that point that you made is so pertinent about not treating women's sport and women's football as a charity case or some sort of fluffy PR corporate campaign, actually properly treating it as a respected sport in its own right will enable it to establish a really successful growth.
Absolutely. And the thing you need to be able to prove that is data. You need business cases. You need to say, okay, here's projected growth. If we invest this much, this is what you're going to get back. And the return on investment is not just money in all cases for women's sports, because the values are very different. It's very much about inclusion. It's very much about diversity. It's very much about like celebrating those differences. I mean, being gay in women's football is really not a big thing in most of the world. In some parts of the world, it still is. But that, you know, that mirrors the landscape of those cultures. But in this country, in America, when Ali Krieger married Ashlyn Harris from the national team to U.S. women's national player, U.S. soccer was the first one to publish it. And it's okay. It's celebrated because that's the part of diversity that, that women's football sort of, can
champions
really,
yeah,
champion. Yeah. That's exactly right. Whereas in men's football, it's very closed off. I mean, there's no gay male footballers on the planet. Really? Like, really?
Yeah. Apparently not.
You know, racism in football is terrible. I mean, I've been to lots of games here in England. I've never, like, it's the worst language I've ever heard, literally, in a football match. And, you know, not that that's everywhere. And I'm not saying that men's football is bad. It's just that it's very different. It's a very different vibe from going to a men's game to a women's game. And that's all changing, and that will change. You know, the men's games are cleaning up. They're trying to, you know, eradicate racism and make it more comfortable for gay players to come out. That may take, you know, 20 years, but at least it's starting to change. And in the women's, you get more hardcore fans and those that are, you know, going to be coming in that aren't just families and young kids. And that's great. You know, that's the development of sports and audiences, but I do think that you need those business cases to be able to show that women's football or women's sports is a commercially viable product. It's no longer just something that we should do because, well, we should give women their space too, you know?
Yeah, you know, I completely agree with that. And so if you were to sort of, for women out there who are trying to make business cases, maybe they work at broadcasters or maybe they are the rights holders, what sort of advice would you give them for making a business case for that investment that we've talked about?
The same way that they would do for starting a new sport, like you were mentioning boxing to me when we were chatting the other day, like or UFC. You know, how the heck did UFC all of a sudden come onto the scene and then become like one of the most engaging, one of the biggest, most crazy audiences? It makes millions and billions. I don't even know what kind of revenue they make.
They make billions. It's a very, very lucrative business,
right? And how do they do that? How did they do that? That wasn't because everyone all of a sudden went, I want to watch people fighting in a cage. They were smart. They made an incredible business case. They showed to all the different types of marketing. The storylines are incredible. They really, you nailed one point right on the head. It's about the icons. It's about the players. It's about the athletes. It's about making these players into icons that you want to watch, you want to follow. And that storyline, like, you can't get enough of it. It's a live storyline. It's like a Netflix series, but live. And that's where I think you need to sort of focus, is back into the players and those stories. So I think it's about creating a proper sort of business structure around that. And it has to include the marketing and the storytelling, and why it's so engaging to follow these female athletes. And it's so easy. It's so easy, Lisellie. Like, really, if you sit down and you talk to any of these top athletes in the world, I mean, I'm doing a thing with Denise Lewis in 2 days or something. And she's just fascinating because she's not only a gold medalist Olympian, but she has 4 kids and she's done tons of other things and she's interested in all kinds of things. And she's obviously in governance now. And I mean, I think women, female athletes, because they know that they're never going to retire and be rich just on that, they know they have to be a little bit more diverse and they have to study or they have to work, or they just have a little bit more sort of depth to their lives than male, let's say, footballers who get put into an academy when they're like 8, 9, 10 years old and don't know anything but football. So it's just different. There's opportunities obviously on the men's side too for that storytelling, obviously. But in women's, I find it very, very easy. Very easy.
No, definitely. I think that point about the stars themselves create that fandom around their life journey. Yeah. I feel like for me, that's definitely the biggest difference I've seen between female and male athletes throughout all sports. And that's not to say, you know, these not compelling male stories. Of course they are. But I would say that's the biggest point of difference. And I think another one I'd like to sort of delve in a little bit more, just before we move on to talking more about your career, is just about that point that women's sport, probably its biggest opportunity right now, given all the challenges as a society we're confronting, you know, together around diversity, the spaces. I think women's sport, for me, certainly looking at it from, you know, I always look at it from a media perspective, is to say, like, I feel like the biggest, most exciting opportunity is the fact that women's sport has done that bit of being inclusive well from the start in its DNA and it's had to be, I guess, because it's been on the fringes, right? But I feel like probably for a lot of female-based rights holders and female sports to really showcase that, the fact that they have actually done the inclusivity piece well, and if they can interrogate, you know, the shortcomings, because they are some that they have, and really sort of almost use that as a business case to the sports industry to say, this is what happens when you create a space where inclusivity and diversity power and are your strength. And maybe that can help the other side of sport, which is more monolithic, let's say, mm-hmm. less diverse, to kind of say, actually, no, there's a super value in us getting our heads around this diversity challenge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we work with, or Copa 90 works with Visa, and one of their sort of main pillars is diversity and inclusion. So if you go back to different companies and what they stand for and what their values are, what's in their, I don't know, you know, when you get sent your package of introduction to a company, the first thing you do is you go and look at the mission statement and the values of the company. And, you know, any company nowadays that doesn't have diversity and inclusion, I mean, the probably won't exist in the next few years. So, and that, yeah. that's exactly, it's such a good point. That's exactly where women's sports sort of fits. Not all women's sports and not everywhere, but certainly from my experience, it's sort of like built into the DNA of women's sports.
Yeah, it seems like an easier one to pivot into a lot further yeah. than others. Yeah.
yeah.
And speaking about pivots, I now want to sort of spend some time thinking about those pivotal moments that have happened in your career, both as an athlete as well as a sports exec, and sort of pick through three key kind of career defining moments or projects that you've had that you feel like really have helped contribute to where you've got to today and your success, but as well as maybe moments where, you know, I'm more sort of that didn't go as well as you would have liked, but the lessons you learned from that have still been so incredibly valuable in making sure that future similar scenarios worked out a lot better.
Yeah, that's a great question. I really like that you did that. I think the first one was my knee injury. So, you know, obviously as a pro athlete, the one thing you rely on is your body. So, yeah. you know, yeah. It's one of those things like it's your number one commodity and you have to take care of it. So everything you're focused on, you're eating, you're sleeping, you're drinking, your mental health, it all relates back to how you're feeling in your body. So you're really in tune with that. And in 2007, right before the Women's World Cup in China, I got a cartilage injury in a training game before we left for the World Cup. And it was misdiagnosed. And I played through the World Cup with it in a lot of pain. And yeah. when I finished, I literally, the last game, I couldn't really walk. My knee had sort of locked up and the cartilage had, you know, come apart even more than the initial injury. So after that, I had to go and get a surgery in Umeå in Sweden because I was playing in Sweden at the time, and then ended up coming back for the Olympics and la, la, la. But so from 2007, I've always had a cartilage injury. And throughout my career, I kind of had to manage it myself because there wasn't proper medical treatment, medical care, physios, doctors around me that really understood the knee and my cartilage sort of damage and how, you know, how do you train so that you can compensate so that you're not compensating for your knee and then ruining your left hip, you know, for example. So biomechanics is so important. So over those years, I didn't have a proper sort of medical team around me. It didn't really matter what club I was in. And when I had to retire, I really struggled because it was the last season when I was playing in Wolfsburg. We qualified for Champions League and I played that season and like my knee would swell up after almost every game. And I remember feeling a lot of pressure from my coach at the time to play because I was co-captain of the team. And so I kind of put my own needs and my own body secondary to what the coach was telling me to do. And it was, you know, in one way you could say it was peer pressure, but also he was my employer. So he was the one in charge of my contract and things. So when I had to retire, it was really not a good situation for me. I had, you know, I really struggled mentally with having to, in the end, just say, do you know what? I'm going to a doctor. I'm going to find my own doctor. I went to Berlin, found my own doctor, got my own treatment, had to pay for it all myself. The club basically disowned me because They just didn't really want to deal with it. When I came back from the Olympics in London, I remember my doctor and my physio saying, hey, let's have a call and we'll do a handover. And they just refused to do it. My club just didn't want to, they didn't want to do it. They just didn't want to, they knew I was injured. They didn't want to have to deal with it. So they basically let me do my own thing. And so I struggled a lot with that, the last season at Wolfsburg. But what that made me realize was I didn't want any other player to have to do that again. So when I got to FIFA, I worked with our medical team. At that time, it was called FMARC. There was a whole sort of a whole division, really, or a whole kind of business where they did a lot of research. And I did that. I created a research project with our FMARC team. I asked all the top players from the 2015 Women's World Cup. And we actually did a research project and a survey, and we got it all back and it was ready to publish. And then, well, we weren't allowed to publish it because of, you know, politics.
And yes, I can imagine a lot of investors trying to keep the reality of what happened, you know, what was essentially a failure of a duty of care to a player, which clubs, you know, are meant to have.
Yeah. And that was the point. So I was asking a lot of that survey was about, well, what are the setups in your medical team? How you know, how well taken care of are you? Do you feel from everything? From, it wasn't just medical, it was everything. And because it couldn't get published, I gave it to my friend Carolina Jonsson, who at the time was the head of women's football at FIFPro, which is the world governing body for the players' unions. And then they published it in 2017. She did her own study. So she took my study and then basically, I think, tweaked it a bit, sent it out to some more players. In 2017, they published the first employment report for women's footballers. Wow. And that was great because it really showed, okay, this is the status of female players. And, you know, there's so much that we can, that we could do so much more with you know, reports like that. Really, yeah. And
with proper resourcing, right?
Yeah.
Proper resourcing to help understand those challenges. And, you know, that experience you're describing of going through an injury like that, it's already probably a very emotionally and psychologically draining experience because, you know, you realize that your body is essentially starting to not longer serve you mm-hmm. the way you need it to keep up your professional career. But that mental challenge, I think you have where you, the support systems around you don't exist, that must have been incredibly difficult to deal with. So what were those kind of moments, in those moments where you maybe you felt like giving up or you felt frustrated, what kept you going? What was that thing, that was that push that made you say, no, I've got to do this, I've got to really channel everything into sure this doesn't happen again? What was that for you?
I think I was kind of, well, lucky, you could say lucky, but I had a really nice support team. So at the time, my boyfriend was incredibly supportive. My family has always been supportive. But even, you know, my teammates kind of didn't want to get in the middle of everything. So it just felt really isolating. But it was just, for me, it felt like, look, my football career is one thing, but it's my life. You know, I'm talking about a knee that I have to walk on until hopefully over 100 years old, you know, and if I want to have kids, I want to be able to run around and chase them. So for me, it was just being able to see a bigger perspective and just step out of my situation and say, I need to do this for my own personal, like, welfare and my life moving forward. And sometimes if you know what your values are and you can always come back to, like, who you really are and what you believe in, then it can even surpass things like peer pressure to play in the last game, you know, for the Champions League or whatever. And that was really hard because it was going against my employer, going against a lot of what my teammates felt, that, you know, they felt maybe that I wasn't trying hard enough, or I don't know what actually they thought, just felt like they weren't there as a support. But it just felt like, I'm not going to do something for others, I'm going to do something for me because I know that this is the right thing for me. And then also beyond that, it was, I really don't want any player to ever have to feel what I'm going through now. Because if you look back, like, I was 29, 30 years old. So I was, you know, a grown woman, had an incredibly supportive partner, incredible family, you know, had enough money from my contract that I could pay for things. So I was really actually in a very fortunate position. But imagine all those girls who were really young, didn't have any kind of support, were peer pressured, and then just kept playing and then literally couldn't even walk anymore. And they're 19, 20 years old. And And it just felt like someone needs to address it and someone needs to try to protect them. So that was why I wanted to do that study at FIFA and get it out to the world so that at least people would know, and the ones that did care or could care or would have resources would make sure that those players were taken well care of. And I still think it's an issue. I still don't think that players are taken care of enough. But yeah, I'm working on some things that hopefully will help them moving forward as well. So,
yeah, no, it definitely. I find that level of selflessness and that ability that you took to have that perspective incredibly inspiring, because I think sometimes it's so easy, as you say, to get caught up in the problem, and being able to take that step back and think, okay, what is my why? And really focusing on that. So that's incredible to see that helped, you know, get you through what was a very emotionally as well as professionally difficult challenge, you know?
Yeah. And I think, you know, for me, sports has given me so much. It really has. Like, it's shaped who I am. It's educated me in all the good and bad and wonderful and scary ways. And so it just felt like for me, I need to give back to the sport, and I need to give back to players coming through. It's very much sort of at the core of who I am and what I think my value on this planet is. Because it everything can improve, everything can always get better. But if I'm, so many people complain about women's sports and what players don't get or what, you know, broadcasters aren't showing. But it's so important, I think, just to try to be a part of that solution, of the solution that you want it to be, whatever that is, even if it's really, really small. You know, even that was why Ness and I started the production company, because we're like, well, let's just try to do it. You know, if no one's listening to us, let's just go and do it.
I love that. Yeah, no, I definitely love that.
That would be my advice, is be a part of the solution. Figure out how you can contribute to the solution in whatever way you know, whatever things match your skill sets, and just do it. Stop blaming everyone else for things that, you may have had hardships, but make a change then.
So yeah. So now just moving on to what your sort of second sort of career defining moment or experience that you had that kind of shaped, you know, where you've got to today. Could you talk us through that and what you gained from that?
Yeah, sure. My second one, might even be a little bit close to home for you, Vaseli, having, I think, spent some time in Jordan, but it was the FIFA Under 17 Women's World Cup in Jordan, which for me was such a game changer in understanding the power of sports and the power of storytelling to try to change culture, to actually be at the forefront of making change. So that was an incredible tournament when we started organizing it. We had Prince Ali of Jordan, who had put together this team of kick-ass women who were driving the tournament. And they were the best LOC, the local organizing committee, that I'd worked with up until this point in my career, because they were just so motivated. They were so passionate about what they were doing and so open to sort of listening to feedback and trying to learn along the way. So it was so much for them about building that experience and trying to leave a legacy. So I spent quite a lot more time with them, sort of trying to give them as much like brain dump, as much knowledge that I had, and trying to bring in some experts. We basically revamped all four of the stadia. We added in accessibility, which was the first stadiums in the Middle East at the time that had accessibility. Wow. Yeah. Because they wanted to be innovative and they wanted to be creative, and they weren't, you know, massive budget. I mean, Jordan is, as you know, in the middle of the Middle East and sort of kind of is the peacekeeper.
Yes, it is. It is. It is the pivot that kind of holds the glue that holds that region together. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's so, I found it just so interesting because I really didn't know a lot about that part of the world, you know, before we went over there. And it was so eye-opening for me to see Jordan, this country in the middle of all of it, everything going on over there, that had all different types of religions and people, and women, you know, some wearing hijabs, some not. And just very, it was a very accepting country, you know, obviously not everywhere and every level, but it just felt like they really, you know, also with the prince and Queen Reina, she is such a strong, powerful role model to women in the Middle East. So it just,
There were so many.
I think globally too, and a lot of how she challenges the norms. You know, what are the culture norms, and also that. I think making that space for inclusivity is so important, right? In terms of the leadership and what you were then able to do and elevate through your tournament.
Yeah, absolutely. And so during that time, I was still working with my sisters. Or actually, no, we hadn't launched the production company, actually. I was just going home, you know, in the breaks and for vacations to LA and chatting with my sister and some people in the industry, in the film and TV industry. And I was just kind of like sharing some of those stories from Jordan, you know, that it just felt like, God, it was so powerful. And they kind of all got entranced by the stories as well. And that was why we pulled together this idea to do a follow doc for the under 17 tournament. So following the women's team, Jordan, because it was the first time Jordan was participating in an event, in an international event as well. It was the first time after FIFA had made the decision to allow hijabs in international tournaments. That was also something that was led by Prince Ali years before. So it was the first time that we would be seeing hijabs in an international tournament, and just the amount of sort of investment and care and love that they were giving these youth players to try to leave a legacy for the country, for women's football, was so cool. So we like pulled together this pitch, and at that time we had a friend or one of the directors and founders of who ended up being one of the founders of JAMA, Dan, he was working with Kobe Bryant in his last season. So he was directing that series, which is going to be coming out whenever that is. And so he had a connection to Kobe. So I remember like I was home and we had booked a meeting and we literally drove down and met with Kobe Bryant and we're like, here's our idea. And he was like, I love it.
What a cool experience.
Yeah. He was like, I love it. I think it's amazing. So he had kind of signed off a couple million, just like that kind of, cause he loved the idea and the concept and was really trying to get behind more women in sports and give more visibility. So he had his own production company at the time. And so the only condition was that we had to get permission from FIFA to have access during the tournament that would kind of close out the documentary. And I mean, long story short, it kind of fell through. I had to kind of step back because I had a, you know, conflict of interest, obviously, within FIFA. So I had to let the JAMA guys run it with our FIFA TV guys. And needless to say, it was a very disappointing process from FIFA's side, that they didn't really see the opportunity, put any real attention to it, give it any gravitas that I felt that could have been a game changer. And so because we ran out of the time, there was a deadline, and we didn't get the access, we couldn't do the doc. And it was a shame because those stories really didn't get told. I mean, FIFA did a small sort of video on it and it was good. I mean, but it could have been so much better, especially with the power of someone like Kobe behind a project like that. So it was kind of like eye-opening for me of how, you know, politics works and how people put importance on different types of projects, and an under 17, you know, Women's World Cup wasn't important enough to make it happen. But off the back of that, we also realized how cool it could have been. Like how, geez, there's so many opportunities actually. If we can get Kobe Bryant to sign off on an under 17 tournament in Jordan, imagine all the possibilities of the things we could do. So off the back of that, we launched JAMA Productions, and it was basically a production company that was dedicated to representing all of the underrepresented stories that need to be told. And it wasn't just sports, and it's not just in women's sports, but one of our divisions was JAMA Sports, and we had lots of ideas around female footballers. And about a year and a half to 2 years out of the Women's World Cup, we had lots of different ideas and went around and pitched them. And so it was cool because, you know, we were heartbroken and gutted, and you know, my sister and her wife and Dan and Aaron and all the guys that had put so much time and effort into like trying to get this project off the ground, they couldn't even come to Jordan to watch the tournament because they were just like, need to be told, you know, and they couldn't. It was just, it was a heartbreak. Yeah. It was absolute heartbreak moment for all of us. But but it also just inspired us to realize, hey, we can do this, you know. And so we did. And so they're still working. And I mean, I've stepped back a little bit from it with now because I've been a little bit more time with COPA, but you know, during this time of COVID, I've leaned back into it, and there's some really nice opportunities, I think, and people are waking up to the diversity that's needed in media and storytelling and starting to put more funding behind it, as you well know, at DAZN, or from what you've seen, not just with DAZN, but I'm sure your experience, Lizelle, that people are sort of understanding that there is an importance for diversity. And of course, you and I champion for more, you know.
We always want more. We always want better. And we should not make any apologies for that, because there's such a big gulf of a gap to close, right? Yeah. So I think to settle for less is not good. And what I really love about the learning from your experience in Jordan, by the way, that was an amazing tournament. I remember a lot of my friends back then really getting excited for the first time, really about being passionate and proud of, you know, women playing sport in a culture where it's not, you know, was not really, let's say normalized, mm-hmm. in inverted commas. For me, I feel like that was such a huge successful moment in terms of changing cultural perceptions and attitudes, which is a huge part of, you know, trying to get people to understand the importance of investing from both a resource and a financial perspective. And I think I want to go back to a little bit more about understanding your initial reaction. So obviously the result was that it inspired you to start up JAMA and to look at other ways you could actually give those platforms that were not, you know, allowed within the current structure you were operating in. But I want to just lean into helping people to understand if they're currently facing, you know, that challenge that you were in that moment where you go out there, you secure funding, you get a great influencer behind it, and the stature of Kobe Bryant, who of course has always, you know, was always somebody who got great spotlight and media attention on him because of the fact he was a great athlete. And obviously he had daughters, and that transition then made him more championing of, you know, women's basketball, but as well as other sports. But what do you do in that situation? So if you're someone out there right now and you're in that same position now, like you've got the funding, you've got everything you need, but you can't cut the red tape, let's say, what would your advice be for navigating that?
Yeah. I mean, I swore a lot during that time when, I mean, that helped a lot just to relieve all of the frustration. No, we were gutted. We were heartbroken. And I think that is fair, you know, like that there's a certain level of emotion that you have to allow yourself to go through when things don't work out. But I think that emotion very quickly has to pivot, you know, as you do in sports, like, okay, I'm trying to go down this corridor which looks open. Okay, wait, there's a defender that just stepped in. I got to pivot to the right. So it's all about just knowing where your end goal is. We knew exactly that we wanted more visibility, and it became very clear after that project didn't happen that we all were on the same page about one thing, and it was about dedicating our time and resources and energy and passion into giving more visibility for those that deserve it and those that need it and those that we feel that the world needs to see to be able to create more more peace, I think, in the world, to be honest. And so based off of the fact that we knew where we wanted to go and that goal was still there, we just had to pivot. And I think if you know where your values are and you know where your end game is going to end up, that journey is going to be quite fluid and quite flexible. I think it's very frustrating when you run into people that are narrow-minded or short-sighted or just not supportive. But there's... You have to also choose your battles. It's kind of like, okay, look, they're not going to change. This is not the opportunity that was meant for us. So where is the opportunity? And you have to choose where you put your energies. And if it's going to be blocked by people that just don't get it, then there's no point in banging your head against that wall, I think. So it's about pivoting. It's about understanding, you know, the long-term game. And it's about just not giving up. I mean, it sounds really hokey, and everyone has said it for years and years and years, but it is. You know, if you really have a belief and a strong feeling in your belly that this is the right thing to do and you're meant to do it, then you just have to keep doing it, but not in the same way. You know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. So there has to be some kind of a change there, and flexibility.
Yeah, no, and I think very much being that being part of that change or solution you want to see is so important as well. When you, as you say, hit the sort of brick wall that you realize, okay, we're at an impasse with these people,
yeah,
or the structure or this particular challenge. How else can I step outside of it to get around it almost?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. In terms of that energy that you then use to, you know, go and move forward with JAMA, and obviously eventually now at COP19, those learnings, do you feel like you almost had to have had that frustrating experience in Jordan to fuel you on to make the big strides you have?
Yeah, I think so. Because it really, what it did is it really kind of gave all of us clarity that, oh man, we really care about this. And it wasn't just that project. So something that was a single focus of the Jordan project, all of a sudden we quickly realized that actually it's so much bigger than that. And I think had that project gone forward, it might have been that we would have all been, you know, really happy and that's one, okay, let's do the next one. But I don't think we would have actually been able to have stepped back and seen this is actually so much bigger than this project. Yeah. So I think you have to have those challenges to be able to get a better or bigger perspective on things sometimes. And also I think that, like, when you hit a challenge, it all of a sudden it tests your will and it tests your determination and sort of the reasons why you do something. So, you know, if you're going through life and everything is easy, then you're not gonna value things as much, and you're not gonna really maybe necessarily realize why you're doing those things. But when you hit a challenge and you go, oh no, I'm definitely getting over this challenge, then all of a sudden you realize, oh shit, this is actually really important to me, I think. Mm-hmm. So I think I've learned more from the challenges and the times that I haven't been successful than I have from all of the things that have come easy to me. And I know that sounds also cliched, but for me, it's absolutely true.
Yeah, but it's you know, it's true, it's factual, and there's so many countless examples of that in so many different walks of life. And I think, you know, when we now sort of move into thinking about your third experience, did you have maybe a particularly high moment or where you thought to yourself, this is the learning and the energy and the same approach I want to take to other things?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I think at JAMA we still like don't feel like there's enough that we're doing, and we still don't feel like there's enough commissioning opportunities for some of the projects that we know are going to be amazing. And it's because it's not a big production company, we don't have a lot of investment and funding to begin with. And we chose not to get investors very consciously. We wanted to run the projects independently, and we felt that editorial voice was so important. So it was a decision that we made. It doesn't mean that it will be like that forever, but we still feel like we need to do more. We still feel like there's projects out there that we want to be doing. But I think we also got quite fatigued knocking on so many doors saying, hey, women's football or women's whatever, or women in sports, or women doing these cool things, or disabled people doing this, or, you know, and getting a slam door in your face or a big no, or a big smile, even worse, a big smile saying, oh, that's great, and then never hearing from them. It's like, you know, it's frustrating because you know that you can do more, and you know that actually we feel that the world needs to see those stories. But not getting the funding and things, I think is tiring. So we took a little bit of a break, and now we're coming back sort of in full force, which I think sometimes happens too, that you have to go in different waves and you have to see where your energies are kind of getting the most flow. So I think, moving forward, we're definitely still together as a production company, and we know what we want to do. But certainly, there's always more, isn't there?
So, do you have any examples of any projects that you've done that demonstrate the kind of investment that you would be looking for in order to really celebrate and showcase women's football?
So COPA invested quite a lot in the Women's World Cup during France, which was in 2019, so last year. And that was something that I really, really could start to understand, that all of the sort of theory that I had been talking about was really coming to fruition in a reality, in a structural form of actually a clubhouse or two clubhouses in France. And that was a project that took a lot of effort from lots of different people at COPA. And then we were on the ground. And so basically what we tried to do was do, like, it was a physical space, but we had lots of different activities so that, you know, even if you just like fashion, we had a week where we had different clubs being able to send their jerseys. So it was kind of like a fashion show, you know, and we had different people coming and modeling the different types of football jerseys, because there's a massive, very highly engaged audience for football jersey collectors, which I never knew.
Yeah, exactly. Hugely so. Like, close to where I live here in Shoreditch is actually one of the main exhibitors, that because I was actually lucky enough to get out to France last year to watch the Women's World Cup, and I went to your Copper House in Paris as well as
I did
absolutely loved it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, cool. It's funny, kind of be moving in the same orbit.
Yeah, that's so funny.
But yeah, I loved it. And one of the things, like, it's really cool. And whenever they have a sale on, in terms of, you know, the retro shirts or the limited collector item shirts, the place is like packed around Shoreditch, and it just shows you that you're reaching a different audience there, right? Because a lot of the people who stand out there, and I've been in one of the queues before because I was trying to get a you know, that sort of old crazy Mexican jersey.
That was a good one.
I was stood there, and there were so many people who were typically just into fashion and street culture who suddenly now had a way into football. So by you guys making that space for them at Copper 90, you then brought a new audience into looking at women's football, right? And that's so important.
Exactly. Or we had like a film festival. So we curated a lot of different films that filmmakers had already done on women's football. And then we had a Q&A with the Equal Playing Field guys who founded the Equal Playing Field, because they were launching their movie in the next like couple weeks. So we showed it. It was actually the first time it had been showed. But then we also like allowed the audience to have a Q&A session with those guys. So if you just like film, you could just come and hang out. If you like fashion, you can come and hang out. If you just like free Budweiser, you could come and hang out. You know, like, so we kind of tried to give 1,000 different reasons for you to come into the clubhouse and be drawn into the women's football universe. But it doesn't have to be that you want to sit and watch one of the matches, which we showed. We showed all 52 matches of the Women's World Cup in our clubhouses too. But you don't have to. You don't have to actually like watching the sport. You can just sort of be a part of a community that is inclusive, that is diverse, that is celebratory and fun, and has lots of different types of interests. So that, I think, was kind of the third project that I really was kind of most proud of, and I can't take full credit for it at all. It was 100% a company initiative, and Tom, the CEO, was very adamant that we're investing in the Women's World Cup and we're investing in women's football, and this is a really nice springboard opportunity to be able to do that. So there was a decent amount of investment that went into that project. And I think, you know, going back to your original question, what are the three things? But there were also challenges and disappointments in that, because off the back of that, I really thought that a lot more sponsors, a lot more brands, a lot more broadcasters would continue with their support of women's football. So, you know, during that time, we had CNN, L'Équipe, TF1, we had BBC, we had all different types of broadcasters, ITV, I think BT Sport was even there at one point, coming and doing like hits from the clubhouse and really sort of being interested. And then afterwards, it was just shocking for me to see it go back to not that, you know, like the OTT player on the
almost an anonymity, right?
Yeah.
And I wanted to talk to you a lot about this, because, you know, yesterday we were chatting earlier, you had a really great session with Denise Lewis where she really expressed, and I think it's something a lot of us who are working in sport and in particular wanting to see huge progress around the visibility and coverage of women's sport as well as the support of it. It feels almost to me, looking at when I look at the momentum and this passion and the fervor that there was last year, last summer for the Women's World Cup, it almost feels like there is a neglect. And I think that was the word she uses, like the women's sport has kind of been neglected. And in particular, I think the momentum around women's football has almost kind of been put on this pause button that yeah. will essentially not just be a pause. We won't be able to resume when all these women leagues come back. I almost feel like in a lot of ways, you have to start again. You're going to have to wait for another boom period, almost like the Women's Euro 2021. Mm. And that feels painful. That feels painful given all the huge strides, you know, you took through COPPA, as well as a lot of other groups like Give Me Sport Women, you know. Mm-hmm. It's a real kind of, I feel like it's a bit of a sucker punch, if I'm honest.
Sucker punch is such a good one. I haven't heard that one. I've heard a lot of discussions during the COVID-19 time about the negative impacts on women's sport, but I think sucker punch feels like that feels like fairly accurate sometimes. I agree. I think what COVID-19 I think has done is shown the cracks that already existed in sports. And then you look at Germany and they have what's called Gleichberechtigung, which is the social equality system. And that's a government program. But what the DFB did, and I just talked to Heike Ulrich yesterday, actually, and she runs most of everything that has to do with sport at the DFB, the German Football Association, outside of the national teams, which is Olli. And she was telling me the entire process of how they made the decisions, because the German Frauenbundesliga is the only league really that's come back. I mean, the Iceland league has continued, and I think Sweden might be starting back up. So some of the Nordic countries as well, but everywhere else is pretty much stopped. And so why is it that the German league could start? It's because the clubs from the Bundesliga, the four clubs that qualified for Champions League, came together and created a solidarity fund. So they put money into a big pot. They gave it to the DFB, which they're not run by. You know, the DFL, the German Bundesliga, is run by a private entity similar to Premier League, but they gave it to the federation to then disperse to non-licensed teams. So all of the teams that aren't in the first men and second men's Bundesliga. So the third men's Bundesliga and women's Frauenbundesliga, the top league, and all of the other clubs and other areas that the DFB thought would make sense to be sharing that money so that all of football could continue. And what Heike said is, she said when she came to that first meeting, they were talking about professional football. And she said, okay, but we're all, just so we're very clear about the definition of professional football, we're all clear that it means the women's top league, the men's top league, right? And everyone went, yeah, of course. Cool. Right. So moving forward. And that was it. And then from then on, women's and men's were at the same level of decision making and put into the same. And they have the same structures as they do here in England. And yet that kind of communication and decision making was not done because it's hard. You know, it's hard to have diversity in your bodies that are making decisions. But they did it right. And now the Women's German League has gotten funding from the men's, which is a separate entity, like I said, and has continued. And so they paid for all the testing and the quarantining, et cetera, et cetera. So I think decision making is so important in how you make those decisions in sport. And during this time of COVID, we've seen that actually where they've done it right, you've had women, Black, disabled, gay, all of the different types of representation on those boards at the table. And then you see that actually they all get the same amount of importance. Yeah, they don't bring in as much money as the Bundesliga, but they're still continuing to play because they see actually it is still a business case. You know, like we need to maintain and retain those audiences that we've built up over the World Cup and continue that. And if we stop the league on the women's, it will set us back. And, you know, if they're looking at it as a business case, they're like, we don't want it. We can't afford to do that. So I think that's the difference. It's a mentality as well. It's how you look at sports and how you look at women's to begin with and the respect that it's given.
I 100% agree with all of that. But I also think more importantly, it's also just a reflection of the society, right?
Yeah.
For me, looking at the countries you listed there, and when I look at the patterns, even in their politics and their leadership in those countries' politics, there is greater representation and diversity, particularly of gender, right? So it's not, you know, when you have that sort of, let's call it a philosophy and an ideology of how you run things, it then permeates in structures like sport, whereas to the example you gave here in the UK, if I look at how our UK politics is organized, that is then reflected in our federations and our governing bodies, and then our sports entities, that they don't have great diversity. And so then, therefore, to be able to value something that is not an immediate reflection of themselves and the space they've continuously occupy is, of course, going to be difficult, right? That is just a fact. That's another reason why organizations really have to sort of take this moment and the learning from, you know, what has been a failure to properly get behind women's sport as a lesson. You know, let's not cower as an industry and say, crap, we got that wrong, and let's just bury our heads in the sand. Let's say, okay, we got that wrong, but what are the lessons we can take? And you gave such a great example there of what has been done in Germany with the DFL and the Bundesliga, the Women's Bundesliga. They got their heads together and they said, okay, what do I have that I could give you that could help you to achieve the same thing we both need and prioritize, you know? And I think, I hope that organizations all around, you know, broadcasters included, like the ones I work for, take this moment to say, gosh, yes, it was a first time we didn't know how to react, but now with the power of hindsight and seeing successes in other countries who got ahead of it, let's learn from that and do it next time and do it going forward and make it the norm, right? Let's make this the new norm.
I think you raise a point there that's so important. It's a signaling too. So the DFB, which is one of the most sort of successful and best run federations, I think, in the world in terms of football, them putting women's football at the same level as professional men's football is a signal more than anything else. And that's, I think, what women's sports needs right now. It needs some big brands like a Visa, like a Barclays, like a Budweiser, who sponsor the NWSL in the US, the league there, saying, yeah, we know this is a good investment and we're going to put our dollars on the table because we want to be seen to be partnering with this type of sport. That kind of signal opens up a lot of opportunity for others to then see, oh, it's important. Oh, it is important. It is worthwhile. It is, you know, a business case rather than just a CSR campaign. And that sort of opens the door and leads the way for others to jump on board as well.
And I guess that leads us on neatly to kind of the final question, which I like to ask everybody. It's been so great. Exactly. Drum roll. But it's been so great to hear about all the different things that have driven you from the moments when you were a player to now, you know, in your role with COPPA, with JAMA, and a lot of other great initiatives that I know and a lot of women take so much strength from you being involved in. What is that kind of final legacy that you want for yourself, Bex? What is that thing that you want to sort of be remembered for or leave behind for the women's game?
Yeah, I think what I want to be remembered for, what I'm trying to do, is to change the face of football, like we mentioned in the beginning. So to really use media and storytelling to be more reflective of the reality of women's football. But it's so much beyond that. I think for me, it's the power of football and using that storytelling in media, and getting the structures right, et cetera, to further and advance society, to make it a better, more educated, more woke, you know, place to exist. That's the world I want to live in. I want to live in a place where people aren't discriminated against, that is inclusive, that is celebratory. And so to kind of set the tone for all the things that I want the world to be like. And so any project that I'm doing, whether it's at COPPA or private projects that I'm running or companies that I'm involved in, you know, helping them in a strategic advisor role or whatever it is, I think that at the end, the ultimate aim is always to make the world a better place. And that sounds so hokey, I know, but I genuinely believe that if that's a world I want to live in, then I'm going to spend all my energy trying to help create that world. And whether it's small projects, big projects, working with players, working with big companies, going on a podcast like yours, which I think is brilliant. Anything that I do, I hope that people will always see that that's kind of the end game. And hopefully that inspires everyone else to do the same.
Yeah, I can tell you, Bex, from personal experience watching you as a player, as well as now obviously having you in the roles that you are, you don't have to hope. You're already there in a lot of ways. And I want to thank you for that, because as we've heard through this episode, you have gone through a lot of personal, professional, as well as emotional pain and growth. And what I really love about everything you do and everything you stand for is that you have done it with the sort of goal of saying, what is my why and how does my why make everything better? And I think that is such an important learning for anybody, not just women, but anybody in this world who, as you say, wants to create a space and a world and a society that they can feel proud and have everyone feel proud and a part of. So I just want to thank you for that. And I hope you take a lot of encouragement and heart from that, the fact that you are real luminary in this space and somebody that I certainly look up to in terms of saying, how can I use my position within the media industry to, as you say, create that new way, that new perspective of looking at and championing sport for women as well as all other groups, not just concentrating on the men's game.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. But I mean, to pay the compliment back to you, I don't think that we do enough of these kinds of knowledge sharing to try to help others and lift them up. So your list of people that you have on your podcast are absolutely incredible. So I'm super stoked to be listening or to looking forward to listening to a bunch of them as well. And I mean, I think it's great. I think it's really great what you're doing. So keep it up, and let's do it together.
I absolutely love that. I'd love nothing more. Thank you so much for your kind words, and thank you to everybody who's tuned into this episode. I've been speaking to the phenomenal Bex Smith, somebody who I see as a real global game changer, and I hope and I really do hope, Bex, that you continue to carry on, because I think you are just at the beginning of a great revolution.
Thanks, babes. Chat soon.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for listening, guys, and look forward to seeing you next week for yet another episode of In Her Corner.